Honorable members, DG and the officials accompanying the DG and the media and members of the public and other distinguished guests, good morning, and I would like to welcome you to this year's work which is starting today. Well, I hope you have had a good rest, because last year was also one year where we all worked hard. We must just check on whether the impact, there was an impact. But we have given another year. If there was no impact, this year around we then make sure that there is a significant impact on our work, because it is about that. Well, the main purpose of this meeting is to get a briefing by the Department of Higher Education and Training on the Higher Education Amendment Bill, which is amending the Higher Education Act number 101 of 1997. As we are all aware, the bill was tabled on the ATC of the 13th November 2015 as a Section 75 bill. Our role as the Portfolio Committee is to facilitate the public participation process as contemplated in Section 59 of the Constitution, as well as amending the bill where we deem it necessary. I'm sure we are all ready. The bill was circulated last year to us after it went through the Parliament, and indeed the work begins. What is important is that whatever we do, we give it our best shot. We make quality, I repeat, quality inputs, so that at the end there can be quality outcome on this piece of legislation without any controversies or complications. So with these few words, I welcome you all and hope we will have a constructive engagement. Thank you very much. We will now move on to item number 2, which is apologies. Any apologies? Or apologies.
Thank you, Chief. We received 2 apologies from members of the committee. That is Mr. Mamapilo as well as Professor Kobisa. We also received apologies from the minister and the deputy minister who are attending the court. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Honorable members, we take note of the apologies. What's important is that we do form the quorum, and therefore we will proceed to the meeting. In terms of the agenda, there is item number 3, which is introduction. I'm checking if we have new people, brand new people this year. Maybe we must start afresh, so that if maybe during holidays we happen to forget people's names, we then are reminded as we start. Starting from Mr. Suela.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Suela. I am the member of the committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Nkadimi Frida, a member of the committee.
Thank you, ma'am.
Good morning. My name is David, and I'm a member of the committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Julie Killian, committee member.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Swangere Mutu, a member of the committee.
Thank you.
Sambran Kamalam Gingus, the Pombasa, he look.
Thank you very much.
Morning, Mr. Chester, member of the committee.
Thank you.
Morning, Belinda Zari, committee member.
Thank you very much. We will then take this role, starting from the other end. say, if you may introduce yourself.
I'm Chris Padilla. You're joining the Department for Education Training.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Daniel Williams. I'm from the department as well.
Thank you.
Good morning. Fellows Patel from the department.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Diego Mboso from the Department of Education and Training.
Thank you.
Good morning. Fellows from the department.
Thank you.
Good morning. Web Conde from the department.
Thank you, Xi.
Good morning. Dan Parker from the department.
Thank you.
Good morning, Yoga Zimbabwe, the Parliamentary Legal Advisor.
Thank you.
I want to have to from the department.
Thank you.
November Bunyan from the Office of the Deputy Minister.
Thank you. And then checking in the back row, are you, yeah, just start the name.
Yeah. Good morning, Mark Rosette from the German Consulate General.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, I'm Sister McKevin from the Office of Legislative Advice.
Thank you. If you can read the voice name, and actually I think you're not switched on, you're on now, right?
Okay. My name is Siwaba Madwakwe, yes, EFL Student Command.
Okay, thank you very much.
So the last go over there, if we can know who you are, because you are our special guest as well, you know, we would like to know who is here. Let's start from that corner.
Good morning, I'm Philip Mugwena, permanent staff member.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, Jackson Burrow, KPMG.
Thank you.
Good morning, Kenny Pacenti from the Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Office.
Thank you and welcome.
Good morning, Yakhada Rita Kirkunda.
Thank you.
Morning, Gay Davis, Eyewitness News.
Thank you, ma'am. May we proceed there? Morning, Chair, my name is Nakolo Mo. Thank you, Nakolo.
Morning, Chair, my name is Nong Farakazi.
Thank you. Morning, my name is Kinyu Nkosi. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson, members of the committee. My name is Ndombizodi Mapabu, Research and the Research and Development Unit of the AEC.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Ayana Kwanz. I'm also a researcher in the Research and Development Unit of the AEC.
Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Joseph Lucia from SABC Radio News.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, my name is Kenny Matala.
Thank you, Kenny.
Good morning, everyone. Morning, Chair. My name is Dumi Majoli, Committee Assistant to Parliament.
Thank you, Dumi.
And then having guests to the Secretary.
Thank you, Amine.
Welcome to Content Advice.
Committee Content Advice. I think we now know who is sitting here, and let me further ask you to, you know, to really feel at home. Well, to all the participants, this is our meeting. Let's make the best out of it. What's important is quality outcome of this meeting. So I'm looking forward to that. Shall we then move on to item number 4, which is briefing by the Department of Higher Education and Training on the Higher Education Bill, B36/2015. Over to you, DG.
Thank you very much, Chair. Firstly, compliments of the new year to the honourable members.
Thank you.
And everybody in the meeting. If I may just introduce Corporal Professor Tiple at my extreme left. He's an interim head of Fago Mahat Health and Allied Science University. And he is here on his capacity as one of the task team members who helped us to develop this amendment. I will just ask Dr. Parker, who is the CTG for universities, just to give us introductory remarks in respect to this area. And Dr. Advocate Boshoff, LSC Director in Legal Services in the department, would actually take us through. Then.
Thank you, Gigi, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. We had to look at the Higher Education Amendment Bill 2015, and just to put into context how we got to this point. In 2012, there was an amendment to the bill that caused a bit of controversy in the system. And following that, we had some discussions across the system, both with the universities and with the chairs of council through their organization, Higher Education South Africa at that time, which is now University South Africa, and the University Chair, Council Chair Forum. The minister met with the VCs, we had a discussion about this and other aspects of the system, and it was agreed that we needed to look at the whole act in its totality, and particularly given that the white paper on post-school education and training was being finalized at that time, that it had suggested that there needed to be a review of all legislation, we would put together a joint task team to look at the issue of the Act. The task team was set up in 2014, and we spent a year working through the different aspects of the Act, and particularly we focused on ensuring that it was now aligned to the new white paper on post-school education and training. We dealt with some of the many amendments that have happened over previous years. I think altogether there have been 9 different amendments. And we ensured that there was coherence in the Act, that it was more user-friendly, that we dealt with some of the key criticisms of the previous amendments, and also that we ensured that all of the things in the Act that were no longer relevant could be taken out. For example, there were mentions of technicons, which don't exist anymore. I think what's important in terms of that process was that it was a quite in-depth process, as the DG had indicated. Prof. De Beer was appointed onto that task team as one of the experts to help us draft the bill, and the task team itself met on numerous occasions. It had on that task team 3 members from the University of South Africa, Ben Issa, 3 members from the University Chairs Council. It had members from the Council on Higher Education. And in finalising the draft of the bill, it then went through quite a detailed consultative process with many meetings with various stakeholders. But in particular, we met with the universities themselves, the general, you know, obviously there were only 3 members in the top team, but more generally. We also met with the private higher education institutions who were affected by the changes in the bill as well and had to be consulted in depth. We met with students through meetings with the South African Union of Students and so on. And at each of those meetings, the bill was presented and it was discussed, and we listened to what the various stakeholders had to say, and their comments were then incorporated into the final bill that came. Obviously, we didn't all agree on everything all the time, but in the end, we came to a situation where we had consensus on the bill that is being presented. I think that if we look at this bill as a whole, and Isaac Boshoff will take us through it in detail, but this bill doesn't represent major policy changes. What it does is it creates coherence across the entire bill. It's a bit of rearrangement of things. It cleans up aspects, ensures that the Promotion of Justice Act and the Information Act are properly taken care of and cognizance is given to them in this bill. And it also, it does introduce a few new aspects which are important for the system and the growth of the system, and after the presentation, we could discuss that in more detail. But that's particularly in relation to the sites, the university colleges and higher education colleges. I'm going to hand over to Advocate Boshoff, who will take us through the presentation. Thank you very much. Over to you, Advocate.
Thank you, Chair. As already indicated, this is the Higher Education Amendment Bill, which seeks to amend the High Education Act of 1997, and it starts to align the provision of the education with the priorities of government and the programs as announced in the the President State of the Nation Address and the National Development Plan. The objective of this specific amendment bill is to provide for technical amendments such as the substitution of the long title of the current act. It is also amending the arrangement of the act substantially. There's been a number of difficulties experienced by the role players in understanding how, for instance, an institute and an institution can be classed in the same chapter, because it's two different types of legal entities performing totally different issues. That's just one of the examples. But the bill is cleaning up the act and provide a more cohesive approach to many of the things that are already in the legislation, but structuring it in a more practical manner. There's a number of new definitions being introduced. It provides for policy frameworks on very key issues. One of them, obviously, is dealing with the transformational goals for higher education system, and it also enhances the policy that is on the development of articulation and recognition of prior learning framework, which is one of the key drivers of the Minister policy directives. The bill also provide for conversion of public higher education institutions. The bill already, or the act already contains different institutional types. And although there are provisions for a declaration, for a merger, for a incorporation, to convert one institutional type to another institutional type, it was lacking. And that was really necessary. So this bill seeks to address that problem as well. It provides for the restructuring of the provisions relating to the ministerial interventions by clustering the minister's directives with that of the provisions pertaining to the independent assessor. It also then followed by the appointment of the administrator, and it provides a logical transition from the least inclusive to the most inclusive by clustering it in the legislation and make it much more understandable and implementable when it comes to the practice. So if I can identify the amendments in the definitions and the application to the Act, the definitions are identifying critical concepts which cause interpretation problems, and there are a number of definitions that have been amended, and there's also a number of definitions that have been introduced in order to provide more clarity and also to provide a better implementation on the understanding of what is in the Act itself. The bill seeks to also combine what is currently in Section 2 of the Act, which is dealing with the application, together with what is contained in Section 70 of the current Act, which is dealing with the supremacy of this Act in relation to all other legislation when it comes to higher education. This is now moved to the front of the legislation in Section, or the bill proposed that it will now be in Section 2, and it is then dealing with the concept of enforcing the contest that this act will supersede all other legislation when it comes to the offering of higher education. The only exception is that of the specific role of qualifications, which is contained in the International Qualification Framework Act, which has already a supremacy clause attached to that specific aspect. Clause 3 must also be read with clause 35. I've already identified the key quality measures or initiatives that of transformation and the recognition of prior learning, but this policy must be read with the current section 3 of the Act, which gives a number of policy initiatives to the minister on the range, scope and operation of a university as a public university sector as well as a private higher education institution sector. And these amendments will enhance broad transformational goals across the board, not only in public but even in private as well, and to open up higher education for all in the Republic of South Africa. The legislation as is currently contained in section 20, which is dealing with the establishment of your public institutions, cause a number of concerns. I've already identified the difficulty pertaining to the institutional parts, but it is also important that it has to be cleaned up, and it provides a framework within which the resources that is required by an institution, and if there is investment, that it is in line within a framework and guidelines from National Treasury. It also provides that the higher education institution invest with financial institutions, and that it that and these investments are currently, which is made by the universities, are sometimes unstructured and vague, and which cause a problem. With this amendment, it seeks to align it with the broader public accountability as is given by National Treasury, and will therefore bring better accountability to such investments. It is not a new provision, but it is a provision which is providing a better understanding, and that is also relating to the new institutional types. We've got a situation that the current Act is talking about a technicon. That institutional type stopped being in existence for quite a number of years. We've been in a situation where new universities had to be established. The new universities must comply with the standards and requirements of that of the university, which provides a full spectrum of qualifications. It is degrees, the full spectrum of the degrees, up to doctoral degrees, research, outreach to your community, and with a new university, it's not possible to deal with it. It is also the setting up of a university, a new university, is a very involved process where guidance and mentoring is required. But this amendment, the approach is to deal with new institutional types. Obviously, university will remain. We've introduced a new institutional type, that of university college, which will have the potential to move to a university, but will be able to be mended by another existing university to that status, Hence, it will be based on a policy that the minister determined in terms of Section 3 of the Act in order to provide the framework within which this development from a university college to a college can happen and be affected. It also creates the opportunity for that institution, that new institution, to build a capacity to do research, to offer a doctorate and postdoctorate degrees, and get the guidance of an established university to assist them with that capacity. And then, the current legislation is talking about a higher education college. That concept has been retained, and it is envisaged that institutional type will be the vehicle that is used in bringing your agricultural colleges into the higher education domain. The amendments to Section 20 and 21 of the Act are therefore a lot of consequential issues that is related to it. It provides also for the university college to deal with the growth and to become a full-fledged university within a policy framework. Although the policy has not been developed, it is a process which will follow, and the lessons that have been learned will guide that process. It will then also identify time frame and resources in order for that university college to move to a fully fledged university within that policy framework. If I can then move to the functions of a council, which is clauses 8 to 10, which is provided for in the legislation currently, is that the council determines policies. The council of the institution will deal with that policy in future they must adhere to it. It must be subject to policy determined by the minister, and it must also recognize the use of Official Languages Act and comply with the provisions of that Act. The amendments also relate to the re-election of council members that is adversely implicated by an independent assessor. In the findings, this has been redrafted in order to give the minister in certain circumstances the power to disregard this disqualification and allow the member affected to continue as a member on the council. Obviously, it must comply with the rules of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, FIRE, and it must deal with the merit of each case on its own. Then it also deals with the current provisions that is in the Act in relation to the conflict of interest, and it clarifies the powers and the decision-making authority of committees and delegated authorities and also staff in order to deal with practical implementation issues which the institutions identify. The legislation is therefore providing a more user-friendly approach to the very important issues of conflict of interest. Clause 9 is dealing with, once again, a current provision. The Act provides for an institutional forum to advise a council on any matters relating to the institution. This will seek to provide an obligation on council that if the institutional forum provides that advice, after the council considers that advice, the council must provide. The reason is that advice has not been accepted. It is a process which is once again in line with the provisions of PAJA, where there is a right given to individuals to request reasons from the decision maker. So the bill further seeks to deal with amendments to section 39 and 41, which is contained in clauses 12 and 13 of the Act. The minister's power to withhold allocations on specific conditions when the institution, when it comes to the payment of the subsidies to the institution, is already in the legislation. But the process that needs to be followed was not contained in the current provisions. So it is no new introduction of powers, but it is merely to enhance procedural requirements, which is underpinned by the PAIA principles, and the Act strengthens therefore the implementation of that provision. Here there's also technical amendments to the record keeping of public institutions when it comes to external audit, which also strengthens the accountability requirements of the universities and higher education institutions as a whole. So as already mentioned, there's a lot of restructuring, and the ministerial interventions is now clustered within a chapter of the Act, and as I've already indicated, it is dealing with the flexible process of different interventions, starting with ministerial directives and moving to the most extreme of the appointment of an administrator. The ministerial directives are clustered as the start of this process, and it provides a main focus on the balance of the institutional powers and the function of public accountability and the framework to ensure that a fair application of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act is achieved. A lot of the amendments are focusing on the procedural requirements, and it is also providing a assistance which is dealing with this intervention. It is also the bill's assist in the logical approach that guides the principle that is underpinning the implementation of this directive, and it also gives a guidance to the independent assessors in dealing with their responsibilities when you move from the directors to the independent assessors. The independent assessors' roles and responsibilities is following that of the ministerial directors as a separate intervention, but it is an intervention which is once again a current provision, but the reference to the procedures were not clearly spelled out. In this provisions, which is contained in the bill, the process of intervention, the powers as related to it, as well as the issues of indemnity to the independent assessor, is now addressed, and it provides a structure that allows the minister to get a report with reasons and which can be used in order to take an informed decision to move to the next one of the implementation of appointment of an administrator. The administrator's role and responsibility has also been clearly spelled out on procedural requirements. It is also providing important new interventions of indemnity for the administrator when he or she performed the functions of the administrator, and it also provides the structure within which the minister can ensure that after the administrator's term comes to an end, that the gains made by the appointment can continue and be effective, and that the whole system is not reverting to a system which is not provided for or which is not aligned with the legislative framework. So the intention is to ensure that the institutions are fully functional and continue to be fully functional after the administrator's term comes to an end. In clauses 30 to 34, the bill also made a number of changes. These changes relate to that of the private higher education institutions. The private higher education institutions are in a very interesting situation, in that as a result of the Section 29 of the Constitution, it provides that your private institution must comply with the minimum requirements applicable to a comparable public institution. But the new universities that have been put into effect by the minister when they were established, they were not in a position to deal with all the requirements of what is the characteristic of a full-fledged university. And therefore, the danger exists that unless we create a policy framework and also a comparability to the institution, for a private institution, it can open up a situation that a private institution who is not at the level of university can insist that they offer a degree and therefore be called a university. With this framework that we have now put in place, the private universities can come and request to be called as a university, a private university, if they comply with the policy framework that is applicable to comparable public institutions. And it is linked to the institutional type. So if the institution provides a full range of qualifications and comply with all the requirements, will also then be entitled on registration of that name to be called a private university. It also gives the opportunity to the institution to use titles in terms of professor and similar, if it is in compliance with the international, or in order to compete in the international domain, but not even within the strict policy framework that is applicable to that. The issue of the registration of private higher education institutions has also become a major problem. In order to deal with the definition of to provide higher education, which consists not only of the registry of the students, the offering of the qualification, the assessment and the certification as a whole, that is the current revision. The amendment now seeks to say that if any one of those components are offered by an institution, that constitutes a requirement for registration. and therefore it takes the difficulty that's currently experienced, that private institutions that are just acting as a recruitment of students for providing tuition, that there's the foreign institution then providing the certificate that is not registered as an institution in South Africa, is therefore addressed, and problem is addressed, and in future foreign and domestic private institutions, even if it is just one function, must be registered in order to act legally within the framework of the Act. The Act further seeks to deal with the time frame within which private institutions must prepare their financial statements. Currently 3 months. The Act is now providing a 6 month period in order to provide a more reasonable time frame for them to comply with the statutory requirements. Chair, clause 36 of the bill seeks to deal with the withdrawal of qualifications by a public higher education institution that has been obtained fraudulently. It is important to identify that this is just one aspect of fraudulent qualifications, but in many cases there are situations where a qualification being awarded and the finding of the fraudulent nature thereof actually came post the awarding of the qualification. The power to withdraw it is now clearly provided for, and it can be dealt with as long as there is a compliance with the procedures of PAJA in order to ensure that the integrity of qualifications are protected. There will be further amendments to other legislation, the NQF Act in particular, to deal with the bigger problem, but this is it was an opportunity to at least start with the problem with the universities, where quite a high focus has been in the past few years on the prevalence of this phenomenon. There is currently a Section 65, capital D, which deals with the offering of trade and occupational qualifications within the higher education institutions. The provision needed to be strengthened and clarified. The bill provides the mechanism where the minister will then identify the specific institution or institutional type that will be liable to provide and responsible to provide trade and occupational qualifications. It is important as a result of the white paper, which identified your public institutions, your universities and your public colleges, to be the public institutions that will offer and award your trade and occupational qualifications. And this amendment will provide the structure within which the implementation of Section 29 of the Constitution will also be effective. It will therefore provide a comparable public institution within which registration can be effected of your private providers. Here, the implication of this Higher Education Amendment Act are negligible to the departmental organizational structures. The policy frameworks that must be developed will clarify the roles and responsibilities between the institutional roles types and it will also require coordination between these stipends and the department. In conclusion, it is important to note that the proposed amendment to the Higher Education Act constitutes adjustment to existing provisions which are already contained in the system, but clarity regarding important institutional principles needed to be made, and it is linked to the extension of the powers of the minister to make policy and to ensure that clarity through policy determination can assist the system to move forward. And lastly, the amendments ensure that the bill is now coherent and better organized and much more user friendly. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Advocate, for the briefing. Honourable members, I will now allow you reflection on the briefing, but also to indicate that today we will be entertaining clarity-seeking questions, because there's this whole process that is going to unfold after this, and I will then take clarity-seeking questions for the Honourable Members. Honourable Member Suela, Honourable Member Kasim, Honourable Member Professor Bozoli, Honourable Member Mr. Mbata, and Honourable Member Ms. Killian. In that order.
Who?
Oh, okay. The last one will be Honourable Member Kekana. In that order. Please let's be short and to the point. Over to you, Mr. Suela.
Thank you, Chairperson. And let me welcome the presentation. I have a question with regard to the withdrawal of qualifications of Clause 36, which provides for the withdrawal or revocation of qualifications, and there's a stated term limit if a material error is found, which is limited to 2 years. And therefore, my question would be, what if that error is identified after 2 years? Will that mean that the person will continue to use the qualification without ever correcting the error? But also to indicate, I just want to know if, for example, the qualification was acquired but fraudulently, such qualification can be revoked at any time when that is identified. Thanks.
Thank you very much for the question. Next.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, the first clarification question, got to do with the entirety of the amendments to the bill. From reading through the amendments in the whole, there are some technical areas and there's certain structural parts of the bill that have been emphasized on. But another observation is that there have been a lot of emphasis on expanding the levels of oversight and the powers of the minister. But without getting into that, my question is, why has there been no, from the reflection of this bill, any emphasis or introspection into the oversight and powers of Parliament as it pertains to this particular piece of legislation? So the question is, has there been, and if not, why not, specific look at how can Parliament's role in oversight in particular over these institutions be expanded and better defined? My next question pertains to Clause 8, Amendment of Section 27, Subsection 5B, which provides that any person against whom adverse findings made in the report of the independent assessor should be given opportunity to submit submission in respect of such findings with a review to soliciting a final decision on the matter from the minister. My question is, does this not provide a level of subjectivity into what would potentially be someone that could be guilty of financial impropriety or fraudulence from within a council, because this section deals with members of council that have such findings against them by an independent assessor, and can allow them, potentially allow the minister to let such person get away and back into the council without any oversight thereof, and it's therefore subject. So I just want to get the rationale behind that from the professor, the result of the task team involved. The next, in terms of subsection 7, now this may be just something that might have been missed, and might have been missed in the previous act as well. When we look at the participation by members of council, and we qualify that participation, and I just want to look at the following two examples. Participate in the deliberations of council or committee of council, or exercise any delegated function in the best interest of the public higher education institution concerned. So this is a qualification of what that participation must be like in council. And the second example is, may not have a direct or indirect financial, personal, or other interest in any matter to be discussed at such a meeting. Now, the contradiction here is that you have representatives, in terms of the same act, of the student representative council that serve on this council. These students will automatically have a conflict of interest, or a direct or indirect financial or personal interest in some of the decisions of council, for example, in terms of taking the fees of the following year, if those students are going to be students to pay those same fees of the next year. And this could potentially exclude these students from these discussions that are imperative or are critical to students themselves who are going to be paying these fees. And in terms of the first example, there would obviously be some sort of interest representing students, not necessarily representing the institution as a whole, as the rationale of putting students there is to be able to bring those interests forward and bring that perspective forward. So I just want to point that out, because that could potentially be problematic in terms of representation concerned. I want to move to Clause 18, Amendment of Section 44, to provide that the minister may, in certain circumstances, appoint an independent assessor without issuing a ministerial directive first. I might have missed it in the presentation, but I just wanted to get the rationale behind that specific amendment. Then moving to Clause 20, amendment of Section 45A amends to subsection 9 by obliging the independent assessor to allow legal representation by a representative from a trade union of which the person appearing before him or her is a member. And when I read this, I might be misunderstanding the section, but the way I understand it is when these are individuals that must cooperate with the independent assessor. It's not limited to employees, it also includes students. And therefore, was there any thought process, rather than only allowing for representatives from trade unions, but also allowing a representative from, say for example, the student representative council, or the student leadership might exist within the institution, because those are like a trade union in for those employees, the representative for those students who may not be able to afford legal representation in that regard. My last question is, the reports in terms of the amendment, the procedure of this amendment bill, speaks about financial implications for the state. I want to ask, has there been consideration given to financial implications for institutions? Because I would imagine that there would be some financial implications in terms of some of the sections that I've read. It might be negligible, but I just want to know, has that been considered in terms of compiling the report? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Professor Kozoli. Thanks, Chair. Just some clarification. First of all, could we see any of the, all the submissions that have been made in relation to this bill? Because I believe that what happens is when you have a draft bill, people are the public is asked to submit comments, and there's no mention of that in your preliminary discussion. And I think we need to see those submissions and assess for ourselves to what extent their opinions have been taken into account. I would also like specificity on what calls were made for public submissions. I know we're having public hearings as well, but I understand public submissions are an additional process.
what calls were made, public submissions, when were they made, and how many submissions were there? What is the formal process for the comments of the Council of Higher Education on a bill such as this, given that it has a special standing in the system? And could you clarify for us the Council for Higher Education or the HTC or whichever body is appropriate views? I heard you saying they were on the task team, but that's not quite the same thing as a formal response from them. The Higher Education South Africa or USA, as it's known, incongruously known, again, was there a formal response from them, or was it just the people who happen to be on the task group's opinions that were taken into account? It seems to me that those are two extremely important bodies whose views we need to know were taken seriously. As far as Dr. Parker's sense that there is very little policy change here, to me, introducing, expanding the minister's powers of oversight in quite substantial, about five areas, is a major policy change, and it actually shifts the balance of power between institutions and the state, I would argue, quite substantially. And another clarification that I need to hear more about is what is intended by the university colleges. Look, it's probably in the white paper, but I don't remember it clearly. Are they key vets that are now going to become universities, or are they what are these things that are going to become colleges and then eventually morph into becoming part of new universities? That's the path that you sketched out. Another clarification point, why is the word transformation not included in your definition? It seems to me to be a very, very vague term, which can mean what you want it to mean. And the ANC has one meaning for it and other people have another meaning for it. So it seems to me that it's something that should be in the definitions. The difference between a university college and a higher education college, if you could clarify that. The powers of councils to determine languages subject to policies determined by the minister in compliance with the official language, and that again is another expansion of the minister's powers, as far as I can see, if you could just comment on that. Can administrators be appointed in private institutions? If the minister's powers are now going to be expanded to the term transformation goals for private institutions, which I don't even think the Minister of Basic Education has those powers over private schools, I may be wrong, but does that mean also his powers extend to such things as the appointment of administrators? It's not clear in the Act. Thank you. In the bill, yes.
Thank you very much. Next.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I have a couple of comments which will later hopefully lead to a much more detailed contribution on my side on what I think should have been the turn of events in some areas of the bill. Firstly, I will start on foreign institutions. I've read the suggestions there, but I have a feeling that we need to be more aware with the growing internationalization of education. We need to be more aware of what is it that South Africa, when accepting these foreign institutions, wants to achieve. For instance, do we need to be placing regulations and requirements on such institutions on issues, for instance, such as their historical cultures? What is it that they bring into the country? Should we also place before acceptance historical due diligence on them, for instance, in their countries of origins, were they well managed? Were they issues around quality, issues around their practices? And inherently we should seek to force them in the requirements also that they contribute to the public good, even though they are private, they contribute to the public good. For instance, the same requirements placed on public institutions should also be placed on them. On, for instance, the demand for local language, they too should have responsibilities in pioneering and spreading the local languages in these private institutions. But most importantly, in the interest of public good, the South African citizens should be protected. I think you should also consider what is most popular with other countries, and upfront deposit against liquidation, and consider having that upfront deposit against liquidation. For instance, it could be handled by the Reserve Bank or whatever institutional mechanism you can establish. The reason for that is historical. Majority of these institutions in some countries have gone broke. And when they go broke, they leave majority of the citizens destitute, and they almost disappear with monies belonging to the citizens. So that sort of protection and regulation should be very important. Now, one last chair in this subject is the issue of curriculum. The interest of all international institutions or foreign institutions should be to aspire to spread all that is good about South Africa in the first instance, which means the curriculum must also, in as much as it is international, it must also be intended to serve the South African public good and the South African economy, meaning the value of what it presents to a larger extent must be enforced to make sure that there is an added benefit to what they are teaching to our locals. The other is on a separate issue now, which I did not see coming out loudly here. The amendment in 1997, in fact, it seeks to create an impression that universities need not to create capacity around internal audit. And historically, with the events that have unfolded or unfolded over the past 10 years, it has told us that universities, by this end in particular, need to be forced to create internal audit capacity. These universities are meant for public good. It is important that good governance does not come as a sheer surprise. It must be institutionalized. Now, most of these universities, through the silence of the Act in 1997, they then hired what you call audit firms to do or to check up their internal audit activities. And majority of them, they will do it on funding available type of measure, which means majority of the activities of the internal audit will always be silent on major part of governance. They will only deal with issues that require the sustenance of the books. But the most important thing about jumping up the university system is creating good governance, good records, good management, good practices, so as to prevent things called corruption, but most importantly also later the administration by the department itself. I also see that you did not much dwell on the creation of a concept called the university ombudsperson to establish a culture whereby it is not only certain legislative players here who make comments such as institutional forum and many others, but also institutionally. There should be a voice around when you want views on whether or not due university must be based on administration, we should also get ideas on what was the institutional culture. So an institution like the University Ombudsperson will obviously compose of many of those inalienable ideas that happen around the university culture. Now, I think the assessor has needs to be much more detailed to prevent what I would call interest. I think the way it's described here, I think you have tried your best, but I think if you, with the previous experiences, I think we have learned a lot today, and I think those lessons must be displayed here. On the representation of the SRC, I see that you continue with the two, I think the representations of the SRC must be extended to consider maybe like four instead of two. Majority of these universities we are talking about now have grown substantially as a result of the measure, and two students, I think they are no longer enough, and that is why the voices of students is collapsing the council. Not necessarily that students, when they represent students at council, they cease to be students. But I think that voice must be heard and be heard strongly. Because councils have tended to wage a war on student issues. I think it's because of the weakening voice also there. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member Bata. The next one is Honourable Member Kigian.
Thank you, Jefferson, and thank you for the presentation. I just wanted to ask if we could just be reminded of the different types of institutions. That would really be very helpful, just to remind ourselves of the white paper. In fact, in preparing for the meeting, it is complex enough to make cross-reference to the Principal Act and to the new Amendment Act, etc., and to also understand the context of everything. So you will understand that the team who worked with us over a period of a year probably know every clause by heart by now. But for us, it is a little different. So that would help. Secondly, I wanted to ask, if we look at the role of the department vis-a-vis private institutions, I just want to ask, if we look at the Constitution, Section 29.3c, which refers to standards that are not inferior to standards of comparable education institutions, obviously in the public sector, it is not incumbent upon the department to also ensure that the qualifications given by these private institutions can also be under scrutiny, so that the same provisions relating to Clause 36, withdrawal of qualifications and fraudulent qualifications, could also apply, because it makes a specific reference to public institutions. And I was just wondering, why do we do that? Why don't we include and extend it to private institutions as well? In the end, it is about South Africa and perceptions abroad about what we are and who we are. So clearly, if we say that the powers of the minister should be expanded, would it be against the Constitution? Not from my reading, from where I am, but obviously there are more clued up people in the department who can help us on that matter. The second issue, the third issue, is slide 10 of the department. I just wanted, we can really pose quite a number of questions, because this is only our very first deliberation on the matter, or clarity-seeking opportunity. If there is a panel of independent assessors, and there is an impropriety that was found, why would it be necessary to have the power to override the findings. Is that not exactly intervening in an independent assessor's findings about a particular person's suitability to serve? Is it not best to stand away? Just a question on that. Lastly, Jefferson, I just want to make a comment that if we expand the role of executive to accept responsibility and accountability for education institutions in the post-school sector, then clearly we must be sure that those powers, as in the majority of these clauses, are curtailed. And you know, fire is written right through the act, the amendment bill. So that's fine. But what I'm saying is, you cannot argue that the minister should be held responsible if he does not have the necessary authority in law to be held responsible. So therefore, I don't have a problem. I just signal the issue about the independent assessment, assessor, and the findings of the independent assessor. That is just my own concern. And then, just by way of comment, Honourable Catherine mentioned that, you know, we would like to see a role for Parliament. I think I would like to disagree with it, because we derive our power from the Constitution, Section 55, and nothing can stop us from keeping, from passing legislation and keeping executive institutions, the executive as well as the administration, accountable. And that is exactly why this Act and the provision contained in the Act is so relevant. So I would like to argue, Parliament cannot be curtailed by any law. The supreme law of the land determines what we can do, and we in fact have all of those powers. So just by way of comment on that issue. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Hillier. The next person is Honourable Member Kitano.
Thank you. The one on the institution, where the Act actually talk about the institution, can we have further clarity about this institution? Remember that the design that is there now is that we have university, tertiary, and community college. Now, and the attitude so far is that more people out of our society must be trained in technical and vocational. In other words, in the last two, TVET and community colleges, and only about 40% must go to university. Now, in the Act, is it able to implicitly or explicitly regulate that type of training, because we think it is very, very important? Somebody was telling me Japan has about 750 universities, and most of them are actually technical universities, where people are not just trained purely academically, but where people are trained to do things, to actually go out there in factories and produce for the economy. So that design is a chapter design in the Act, where you train 40% in university and 60% in TVET. Because I think that is important to guide by law our way of education in South Africa. The second one is on the power. You know, I personally now and then get worried that when things go wrong with education in South Africa, whether higher education or post-school education, universities, the first people that take the flag are the governing party. Now, if anything, whether it's financial or standard of education at university, if anything goes wrong or failure rate, people don't say vice chancellor or council. They say this government. So in a sense, whether we like it or not, government must take responsibility. It must oversee something similar to what Mrs. Honorable Chilean was saying, that Parliament oversees according to the Constitution. And that is the understanding of the society, I would imagine, even international community. Because nowhere will anybody play by central council, but all the time government. So in the legislation, though you also at the same time respect academic freedom, that those especially who are there in discipline should be respected to administer the production of knowledge in those disciplines. But the overseeing factor, are all the schools captured there? I know that some of you speak about the minister, but is it captured so that in the ultimate government is able to oversee, because in any case, ultimately, they are the ones who will take the blame if things don't go right.
Thank you very much. I will now cross over to the department to provide responses to the issues raised.
No, thank you very much, Chair. I think the questions that have been posed by the honorable members are quite encouraging. But I want to emphasize that what we need to do as a portfolio committee, and I think as a country, is to work out as to what would work better for the system in its reconfigured form. What would you like your child to come out of any of our institutions looking like? As a parent, in that context, then, what would be ideal in ensuring that you are able, as a parent, to derive that satisfaction from the system? Because as a parent, whether it would be in respect to a school, a college, or a university, there is something that you look forward to, you would like your child to get out of it. It would be quite important, therefore, that all of us, when we're looking at victims, we have applied our mind on what could work better for our children and the generations to come. And I also want to emphasize, you know, upfront that councils have got an important role in the institution. The question is to how could we strengthen them to do their work better and productively. Of course, there are pertinent questions that are being asked, and engagements are still going to ensue through public consultations and engagement. And in that process, it would be quite important to work out what would be the proper checks and balances across the system from whatever quarter. Because if we would do things that in the manner in which they present themselves would weaken the system, I'm not saying that would be an intention from APFA. We stand to regret, all of us, because we know how these institutions should be, what they should be able to produce, individually and collectively. So I'll ask Professor Christy here to start, for some of the questions were directed to him, but you are welcome to engage, you know, on issues as you have experienced and processed, you know, in the tasking, and the advocate also as well as I, you know, come in. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Educator.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, honorable members.
I will start with a question around the 2 years withdrawal of fraudulent qualifications. I think one should just read the proposal carefully. It's saying that in the instance, only in the instance where the public higher education institution concerned made a material error, in other words, an administrative error, then you can't revoke that qualification after 2 years, because it will have a major prejudice on the individual, because it's not the individual's fault. It is the fault of the institution, and the 2 years is confined to that particular instance. It is subsection A and B are linked by the words or. If it is the result of a fraudulent or dishonest act in connection with the obtaining of that degree, then there is no time limit. Then, of course, any time the qualification can be withdrawn. I just wanted to clarify that particular part. The other question that was actually directed to me was around the finding of the independent assessor against an individual. If you assess the current situation in the Act as it is, this finding is made against the backdrop of not clear prescripts to the independent assessor that would lead to an absolute compliance with FIRE. And it says here that if that adverse finding is made, this person may never ever serve on the Council of University. Now, one should distinguish here between an instance where a student, for instance, participated in a protest march and something was broken in the process. Now, are you going to ban that individual, that young student, forever from the possibility of serving on a council of a university? This is what could be the consequence of an adverse finding by the independent assessor. And this is one of the 2012 amendments to the Act that was perceived to be very harsh by the sector itself. The new proposal is saying that also in compliance with, make sure that you have compliance with PIA and actual justice. If that adverse finding is made, and that adverse finding will now be made against the backdrop of a much better prescribed procedure to be followed by the independent assessor. If that adverse finding is so made, this individual, in terms of what is fair, should be afforded another opportunity to put his or her case. Because this is sort of career limiting. If you never ever allowed to serve on higher education institutions council. And we then struggled with where should this person go? Should this person now go to a court of law and try to have this reversed? With all costs associated with that, this individual may not have the means to do that, and to go to court, you know, it's quite a different story. So we thought that there should be an administrative process built into the Act through the Office of the Minister. And it's quite clear that this is also an attempt to have a further compliance with FIRE, because the Minister had to receive these recommendations or submissions, consider and then make a decision with regard to the seriousness of the contravention that happened at particular time. I think it's a much better approach to a very difficult situation that may arise. I just wanted to also respond to another question around the white paper, and where would you find some argument or reason in the white paper for the different categories that's now presented. I looked at the white paper, and on page 29 at the bottom, there's a discussion and a discourse about differentiation in the system. explained that we're not going to tamper with the three types of universities, namely the traditional universities, the comprehensive universities, and the universities of technical. Category, those categories will remain. But if you read that paragraph at the very end of it, it provides for a differentiation where some institutions would only focus on undergraduate education, others then focus on a broad spectrum. That's one reason I think why this differentiation was also now taken onto the amendment bill. But the other one, especially with regard to university colleges, I think we've learned a lot from the establishment of the three new universities. You know, what are the dynamics that you have to deal with there? It's a capacity issue. It's also a quality issue. And that's why you may start off by establishing a university college rather, and then apply what is proposed in the amendment act with regard to supervision, with regard to an immediate possibility of having the total capacity and the expertise and the quality levels of another established university available for this young university to benefit from that. I'll stop there for now.
Thank you, Professor. Is there another topic?
Yeah, if I can just, the issue of consultation that has also been mentioned. Chair, the department is of the view that this amendment bill will actually focus on specific issues raised by key role players, where there is no major policy deviation. And the approach that we followed was not to open up a broad, open discussion, but to engage with those role players on identifying the specific issues and dealing with that in particular. And that's why the task team has also been established, not as to provide an open session for amendments, but deal with it on a focused and dedicated discussion. One of the criticisms we've received over the years has always been that you call for comments from the minister's side, the minister receives the comments, there's no engagement, there's no understanding why certain issues have been accepted and why not. So the consultation process, we can provide minutes of our meetings with the dedicated role players which are affected or actually raise these issues that has been contained in this legislation. But there was no wide open publication to call for a broad amendment to the Act. This Act has been reviewed on a number of occasions, and in fact even some of the Green Paper comments were already contained in amendments that was made the previous round. So the issue was not to deal with an open-ended review, but specifically to clarify the concerns that Professor De Beer also raised and the DG raised before as to the role players in the amendments that came about in 2012. So the other aspect that been mentioned is that of the independent or the private institutions and their roles and their responsibilities, especially when it comes to the financial viability. The Amendment Act obviously addressed just specific aspects of what is in the Act. When it comes to the registration of private providers, there are a whole chapter dealing with it. which specifically requires for financial viability, which is a key focus in the registration process as is provided in the regulation. Those assets have not been tampered with. It is exactly the same as it was before, and it is not covered by these amendments. It's still in place. So financial viability, financial surety is already part of the system, and it is already catered for. The amendments are actually dealing with the compatibility and also the competitiveness between your public and your private institution and globally the environment where a institution of our standing must be able to get visiting professors in order to enhance processes, and that is why the amendments being affected to open up that issue. The issue of why was it not necessary to ask the CAG to advise on this specific legislation was one of the questions. The issue is that in terms of specific requirements in the legislation, CHP had a specific responsibility to deal with policy amendments, not legislative amendments, policy amendments. If the minister put policy in place, the minister must first consult and thereafter can deal with it. In this particular case, the CAG has been, and members of the CAG obviously were involved in the task team, but the statutory requirement is only relating to policy, and therefore there were no specific need to get formal legal advice from the CAG before the minister can act. Furthermore, it is also important that legislation is a function of Parliament. And the decision making is with Parliament, not with the minister. The involvement of opinions and advices from the CAE will assist this committee and not the minister in order to finalize it. And therefore, it is the reason why the Constitutional Court also prescribed that Parliament, through this policy of this committee, provide public hearings in order to deal with this type of input that is critical for the decision makers to inform them in how to take their decisions in a correct way. Just the last issue that is important is that when it comes to the fraudulent and misrepresented qualifications, It is wider than the Higher Education Act. We are just addressing the tip of the iceberg. The main amendments will be in the NQS Amendment Act, where the issue of the appropriate authority, which is SAQA, will take a leading role in identifying and also have measures in place. It cannot be dealt with. In this case, as Professor De Beer indicates, it is merely for those who made a mistake to rectify a mistake, and for those who can deal with it in an appropriate manner by revoking that decision. The time frame of the 2 years, Professor has already indicated the reason, but just to add to that, it is also in many cases that a fraudulent qualification being obtained, the next year that person continues with an honours degree, there's no problem with an honours degree. Now, what is the implication? Are you going to revoke that degree? And it's that type of issue, and that's why a 2 year time frame is a very important one also to identify. Obviously, it is not cast in stone, but it was seen as a reasonable time frame
within which one can rectify the whole. The other last thing that I need to respond to is the issue of the different institutions. The question was, is there any message that your TV colleges are now becoming part of the college that is referred to in this specific piece of legislation? It is important that this act is dealing with institutions that offer higher education qualifications as on the sub-framework for higher education, which is the university and your tertiary level of qualifications. When it comes to your TVET, which is linked to your further general and further education and training sub-framework, the one that is covered by Malusi, that framework is not affected. It is under different legislation. The institutional sites also are different. With TVET, it is at your community colleges, community education and training colleges, they are embedded in terms of continuing education and training legislation. This is an amendment to what is contained in Section 20. Section 20 already referred to colleges. Now, colleges is vague, the term colleges is vague, and it is not clear what is the distinction. Now there is a qualifier to it, it is a higher education college, which will have a specific niche within which it will operate. It will provide qualifications within a specific framework, and it opens up also the sub-framework of trades and occupations, because a college and in the TVET and the CET environment, as well as a college in the higher education environment, will be affected by that provision, and it will be clarity. Then the last issue is why only is it that public universities can revoke and not also private universities when it comes to qualifications? The provision obviously is an important aspect. The main function, as I said, to deal with the revocation of or the management of all fraudulent qualifications are within a different environment. And we are very hesitant to deal with it in a piecemeal approach. It was quite a discussion even to introduce it at this point in time for the higher education public institutions, where at least there is a much better control and also a system in place in order to verify. The word fraudulent on its own is a very loaded concept. It means a specific intent to defraud, and in many cases it is even a fault of the institution itself. And that is one of the complexities. The approach is to deal with it in a system, at least where there is better insight and access to the data in order to verify what is fraudulent, what is misrepresented, and how you can deal with it. And obviously, it will roll out, and the letters out of this process will also be brought forward when we deal with it in the next round with the national qualification framework. But it is a very complicated issue, and we are worried that if you deal with it in a too wide approach,
you will not be able to implement it properly, and therefore you can provide more damage than good to the system. So, thank you, Advocate.
Guy, then Prof, you run down.
Thank you very much. I think most things have been covered. There are just two aspects I would like to focus on. The one was around the question relating to privates and the curriculum and issues of quality. Just to indicate that we haven't got anything specific there in relation to that, because every single institution that offers any of these kinds of qualifications has to be accredited through their qualifications have to be accredited through the process of the Council on Higher Education, including any foreign operations in our country. And what this does is tightens that up, and it insists that every single institution that's operating here, no matter what little part they play within a higher education process, will have to go through those particular kinds of quality assurance processes. So I think that's important. The actual indication in terms of what is contained in the curriculum is part of the criteria of the CHE in terms of getting a particular qualification accredited. So I think that is covered. The other issue, just to maybe build on what Pastor Beer indicated around the institutional types. As he indicated, this links to the differentiation in the system. And our experience over the last couple of years, as we've understood, that the system in 1997, the way in which the thinking was that you needed to merge everything, make fewer institutions, and you would never grow new institutions again. And that actually, we've realized, was not the correct way to think about it. We have to have an act that's enabling, that enables us to understand how institutions grow and develop over time. Our experience of developing universities on Pumalanga and Salt Lake University particularly really led us to understand that we needed something called a university college. That is how universities have grown historically over time in the world, through the establishment of university colleges. And if you think now of the latest university we created, Salt Lake University, and the complexity around having to do that, there was already a campus there of another university, but we had to establish a brand new university with an interim council without much experience of higher education, get some interim management in place, and then incorporate the campus into that university. Whereas it could have been a much easier situation where the minister declared that campus at a university college under another university with very good governance and quality measures, it could then be guided into becoming and growing into what a university should be, and then at that particular time be declared a university. So it enables that kind of movement. In terms of the higher education college issue, it's about the scope and range of activities and the purpose of the institution. So we're looking at higher education colleges being predominantly undergraduate institutions. It will also offer, for example, some of the QCO programs and skills programs, but that's what they'll be focusing on, higher certificates, diplomas, degrees. So while they're often higher education, they will not necessarily be involved in developing huge research programs. And those particular institutions then, if they do grow and they show the potential to become a university and that's seen as being needed in terms of the broader planning process, could be declared as a university college and then grown again. So what this allows us to do is to have a more differentiated system where we can have institutions that are offering mostly undergraduates, others which are offering a range, with some that are more focused towards the postgraduate qualifications within the range of the current university types that we have. So I just wanted to clarify that and perhaps then hand over to...
In actual fact, it's not even just international. Red, if I'm correct, it started as a mining college.
but today it's a huge university with the quite reputable, you know, standing in society. Yeah. And we have to dispel the notion that in building an institution, it would be like an instant coffee. Because there are a lot of systemic things that would have developed and evolved over time. No, it's not an easy thing. I know we may be tempted to just see universities all over, you know, coming up. It doesn't work that way in some instances with respect to the establishment of a system. If you want to ground them quite properly and you let them develop and grow over time, there are a lot of things that need to consider and build into the system. On the question of international curriculum, now this matter we discussed it quite extensively at the Higher Education Summit. And it came out that we need to ensure that we actually locate the development of curriculum domestically as well as global now, but it must also be international, because you don't want to produce graduates who would be confined only here in South Africa or just the continent. They must be able to be usable, of course, from the standpoint of their strength globally, because now we are competing quite globally in every respect. Prof.
And Chair, with your permission, I promise to be brief, but I think it's fair to the honourable members to respond directly to some of the questions asked. And I would like to, with your permission, do that, but it's not going to take a lot of your time.
Professor, please feel free.
Okay. The first one pertains to the conflict of interest, specifically with the students on council. Now, conflict of interest is rife within that context on a council of the university. Because you have the Vice Chancellor as a member of the Council, you have Deputy Vice Chancellors as members of the Council, you have members of Senate who are members of staff sitting on the Council, and the conflict of interest that was alluded to is within that domain. And I don't think that's what the Act is actually trying to prevent. In terms of your position at the university, you may clinically have a conflict of interest, but the Act is not dealing with that. It deals with the specific where you have interest over and above that you should declare. So that I don't think one can resolve unless you tamper with the composition of councils. To say no member of staff, no student would sit on the council because you have a conflict of interest as a member of staff or student. Could I just say that the question whether we should increase the number of students on the council from 2 to 4 whatever. One should just be reminded of the fact that for every 2 internal people, or for every 1 internal person that you appoint on the council extra, you have to appoint 2 external people to keep 40-60% composition of the council. And what is allowed in many of the statutes of university, as far as Senate are concerned, is no more than 2. Because there is also a maximum number of members of the council currently prescribed not to be more than 30. And if you now appoint 2 internal members, then you have to appoint 4 external members. So it's a total of 6, and most of the councils would not be able to accommodate that. I don't think it's the numbers that influence the voice of the students on council. I think it's the way in which the culture within that particular council has been developed by specifically the chair and the deputy chair of the council, whether the students would feel free to participate, not only as members of the student community, but as members of council, because they're sitting there as members of council, and they have to act in terms of the act in the interest of the institution. That is clearly prescribed. Then the question around the why is that the minister still can directly appoint an independent assessor without issuing a directive. That is still possible in terms of the Act, but only under certain prescribed circumstances, which you'll find in Section 45 of the Act. And those are instances where it's quite clear that there are financial irregularities, and the council is not dealing with it. There are two instances, or a couple of instances, mentioned in Section 45. So it's not a carte blanche for the minister to do that now in any case. He will only do it in the limited number of instances listed in the Act. Then the representation before an independent assessor, I think that might have been oversight. Not to say that the student could be represented in some way or the other, because they may not be able to hold a legal representative. And I think that's something that as the process continues, that you could look into. Then as far as the CHE is concerned, I have to say I'm a member of the CHE, and the CHE has discussed this amendment bill at least twice at council meetings and decided that it's not going to respond to it now, but it will respond to it during the public participation. So the CHE will be there and will put forward its position on that. As far as yourself is concerned, the old Yesa, they participated in the process through their legal committee, and their legal committee reported regularly back to the board, and what was agreed and what was proposed by Yusuf came directly from the board of Yusuf. And I must say that if not 90%, at least 85% of what you would find here was signed off by Yusuf. And we had quite a long and intense debate on how these matters should be drafted and how we should not allow it to impact on the university. The statement was made that the position or the powers of the minister have been expanded. I'm not sure by reading the Act carefully that that has happened. On the contrary, the minister is now obliged by pertinently scripting the Act to do much more before it can act in terms of the Act. Due to what you would find in prior in that Act is actually translated into the procedure here to guide independent assessors, administrators, and also to guide the executive. And to make sure that you not only have a formal compliance, but the way in which it's drafted here is substantive compliance with a piece of fire. So I think we should be careful, around saying that the minister has now received an open checkbook to do more in terms of his power. As far as private institutions are concerned, and Chair, the private institutions participated actively in this process. They sent a delegation, they sent a documentation, quite substantial documentation, articulating their needs. And what you find in the Act here with regard to the categories and whether they could call them universities and they could use certain names like professor and vice chancellor, all of that came directly from the needs that they've articulated. They also, at the time, articulated their willingness to subscribe to the fundamental issues in the Act. And the reason why we haven't made these prescripts directly applicable to private higher education institutions is because we believe that it should happen through the registration prescripts and the conditions that will be set by the department, because the DG is the registrar of these private higher education institutions, that one should include in the recognition and the registration prescripts the fundamental issues that is described in the Act, for them to subscribe to that by way of the registration and eventually the department and the minister could hold them accountable if they do not comply. And of course it would bring the continued registration into play. I think that is what we've decided would be the prudent way of dealing with it. Because of the reason you find in this particular prescript where you can withdraw a qualification, we say the Senate can withdraw it. Now we can't prescribe to a private institution whether they should have a Senate, whether they should have a board, and who should be the governance, and how should the governance be set up in the private institution. That's why we thought through registration prescripts is a much more elegant way of achieving exactly the same without now prescribing to these private institutions how they should set up their business. I think, Madam Chair, that's, I think, sounds more direct to some of the questions. Thank you.
Maybe the last thing, Chair, I want to really alert the portfolio committee members. Now, our experience in respect to operation of council across our institution is that what normally paralyzes these institutions to deep conflict is mainly internal interest groups, especially with respect to procurement issues. They really paralyze these institutions. That has been our experience. So it's a matter that we need to look at quite cautiously, and we should avoid idealizing it. It has really cost the system quite a lot, because it ends up impacting even on the quality of provision of programs in the respective institutions. Because when those programs rip council, but everything really falls. So we have to look at this in a very considered way. That is the submission that we are putting to you as law makers, that to press importance to actually look deeper and research some of the permutations and processes in respect to the functions of council in our institution.
Thank you very much. I see that the responses sharpened the appetite for members to engage further. Honourable Member Kasim, Honourable Member Mata, Honourable Member in that order. As long as your follow-up question will be short and to the point. Yes, in that
order. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, there were two questions that were not, or I did not feel was answered adequately, so I'm going to repeat that, if that's fine, and then just move into follow-up questions. The first was regard to whether or not the task team and those that worked on this bill had fully considered the expansion and the definition of parliamentary oversight, and in particular in concurrence with the actions that need to be taken and interventions that need to be taken, the principles of tri politica and checks and balances that could strengthen the system. The DG says that we must think about what we want this environment to look like and what we want how we want our institutions to be able to function in each environment. I'm sure we all want the environment to be as accountable as possible, or as reasonably possible. So I just wanted to ask that question if that was truly considered, because I don't think it up anywhere in the amendment law. And I think that there are many, many innovative ways in which these checks and balances can be strengthened and defined in order to create more accountable environment in which the minister, of course, the minister must be able to act within, but we want it to be an accountable environment in terms of separation of powers. as they find itself in the Constitution. So that's the first question. The second question, again, I'm going back to the financial implications on institutions. And this is very significant, Chairperson. In complying with the Act, there would be, and I'm going to give an example, and perhaps this can be clarified better for us, there would be circumstances in which institutions would need to act and that may have financial implications. For example, in the amendment of Section 65G, provides that minister may identify higher education institutions who shall be obliged to offer education program, trade and occupation learning program, etc., may have a financial implication on that institution. So there are financial implications that may implicate institutions and had that been considered and factored in as well. Then just follow up questions, Chairperson, on the response that was given to the amendments in Section 27 as it pertains to, just give me 1 second, as it pertains to an adverse finding by an independent assessor and allowing that individual to solicit the final decision on the matter from the minister. And the response that we received, I think, from Professor De Beer was that it is in order to provide some manner of recourse, and an example was given of students that may be implicated and so forth. Surely, Chairperson, there could be a better way in order to provide recourse in accordance with juristic principles than merely just allowing the minister to decide who should get away and who should not get away. What this opens the door to, Chairperson, I'm not saying it will happen, but it does provide the opportunity, is for when there are members, and not necessarily students, that was just an example that was given, but when there are members that are implicated, and we've seen this on a variety of occasions, particularly in procurement, as the DG has alluded to, or in the interference of the institution's procurement processes, you will find that some of these members may be politically connected, and you will find that some of these individuals are in many instances the root cause of a lot of the problems and demons that affect the institutions themselves. My question is, surely there can be a better way and a more accountable manner in which to provide recourse for people that have adverse findings against them, rather than the manner that is purely put here, which is open to abuse by whoever the minister may be today or tomorrow or the following day as well. And the next follow-up question, Chairperson, is as it pertains to the issue that I had raised, when it comes to those that may not have a direct or indirect financial, personal, or other interest in any matter to be discussed in council. And I do appreciate the response. That is the environment that council members operate within. But that is perhaps implied and not defined. And being someone who had previously sat in council as a student representative, I know all too well how various sections of legislation can be used to stymie the participation of various sections of council in decision making and to intimidate in that regard as well. And perhaps there needs to be some sort of introspection or thought given to how can we better define what is an acceptable conflict of interest in terms of discussions and decision making of the council. And what are the boundaries thereof? Because that can be applied very inconsistently if that is not well defined, and I've got personal experience in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And next, Mr. Mbasa. Yeah.
Thanks, Chairperson. I am just going to be short. I just want to make an inquiry again. Firstly, when the proposal for the Institutional Forum in the First Act was brought about, it was aimed at not only transforming the university cultures but also to ground them on accountability, transformation, priorities, and nation building. One of the ideas was that the institutional forums will assist democratize or demonstrate the extent to which the universities or higher education institutions will internally practice democracy or internal democracy. And I think it has been enough now of that. What we have seen preoccupying institutional forums more recently, it is the struggle to find the lessons of that cause of democratization into institutional culture. And if we do not support them through institutionalization of establishment of a good university culture, we are not actually extending the sphere of this entity in particular. That is why I was raising the issue earlier of the university ambassador. Because apart from the fight that demonstrates the workings of the institutional forums in today's environment, it is the inherent what I would call forces at play. For instance, we find that the grouping that represent, I'm just making an example, the Senate, the union, the students, will have vast opinions on exactly what should be the culture of the university. Majority of the Senate, well, but not in all institutions, might as well still consist of very traditional, very, I will not say right-wing, but very conservative type of person. And this has been a struggle in the past 17, 18 years in how institutional forums translate and win a war on a progressive culture that this university must have. There seems to be this steadfast and backwardness and back and forth in grounding what is the culture. Up until today, very few universities, even after MESH, have actually discovered their own culture. And to me, that is a threat, because at the end of the day, we are just not able to reach out to exactly what is this animal that we are constituting as universities. Two, the amendments at some point, it will be interesting to note it during the discussions and the presentations of those parties that you met, what has been the new generation of ideas now around institutional autonomy?
Thank you, Honourable Member Mbata. Over to you, Honourable Member Mutunu.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think for me, the amendment bill is long overdue if we are saying that we want to see a higher education transformation, higher education system which is transformed. My question is around, or clarity is around transformation. I would like to know whether the bill does clarify in cases where institutions are not showing progress with regards to transformation, who then becomes responsible? Because ordinarily one would assume that it would be the government. I think that one, because we have institutions that are resisting, what do we then do with those institutions? I think that point needs to be reflected in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm now crossing over to Professor.
A couple of questions, with your permission, Madam Chair.
Let's start with the issue of Parliament and oversight of Parliament. Already in the bill, when it comes to finances and the withholding of finances from universities, in that already there is a provision saying that the minister has to report that to Parliament directly. I think it's section 45 or 44, and section 42, 42.4 is already saying that with regard to a specific issue. What we've inserted in the amendments, though, is that when the minister, for instance, appoints an assessor, he's now obliged to publish that to the Government Gazette with a view to informing everybody what he is doing. And I'm sure that Parliament could take up on you know, having been informed publicly, you know, of certain issues that they would like to take up with the minister in particular. And then our understanding of all the reporting regulations that are applicable to institutions, those reports that we submit annually, due on the 30th of June every year, those reports, my understanding is, that should actually be, those are public documents and should be made available to Parliament. But I need to be corrected on that. So the oversight is built into then indirectly, I think, into the Act, instead of having it explicitly drafted, except for the ones that are the one that I've alluded to. On the functioning of councils, I'm not going to go to the cost for institutions and the minister's discretion. I've tried to give you my best answer on that one. And maybe one should look at a dispensation where the minister should consult in a way before he takes a final decision, just to give comfort against a possible, you know, fear that you may see in sort of this whole thing. But the functioning of the council of universities, some of the issues raised here have to do with that. And in the statute of the university, there is a full exposition, or there should be a full exposition, on how the council should function. And what I am also propagating nowadays is there must not only be the code of conduct, which is actually also compulsory nowadays in terms of the Higher Education Act, but there should also be a charter for the council itself, describing how it should function over and above what is already in the statute of the university. And if the council is not functioning properly, all of these things that the DG actually alluded to will come to the fore, and that would become the Achilles heel of that university. The moment things go wrong in the council, then it's problematic. And of course we have, I think, through the department, all of those programs, where we focusing on the induction council, and it's also sitting councillors of what their responsibilities would be. The IF, the institutional forum, the ombudsman, with institutional forum, there are a number of issues in my view. Apart from saying that it's an advising body that should advise council on certain issues which is prescribed in the Act, the Act only refers to the statute of the university. And I'm not aware of any prescript to say that you should have in the statute a comprehensive exposition of how the institutional forum should function. In many statutes of universities you may find that there's only high-level references to the institutional forum, and that the constitution of the institutional forum is actually in the statute referred to be dealt with in terms of institutional rules. And there may be a problem that in some institutions, those institutional rules might have been drafted in a way that would inhibit the functioning of the institutional forum. What we now try to do through this particular proposal here is, and this is something that happened in the past, that this advisory body would advise, but the council would not even have it on its agenda, would not even bother to respond. What we're now saying is, it's compulsory for the council to receive the advice. And not only to receive the advice, but to consider it. And should the council take a different decision to the advice provided by the Inclusion Forum, the council must give reason for that. That's how far we can go against the backdrop of the Institutional Forum being an advisory body to the council. And it's not an advisory body to the management. It's got the prerogative to send whatever it wishes to advise directly to council. And it's the only body at the university, in terms of its current composition, where you have all the internal stakeholders of the university sitting around the table, in their capacity, not as a member of staff. There are members of staff represented, but also as the union. As a recognized union would sit at that level. Where the staff association would sit at that level, where you have the students at SLC members sitting there. It's the only complete forum that I know of within the university environment where all the stakeholders would be in one venue discussing what is within their mandate. And I don't think all of those opportunities are being used optimally. It's also prudent for whatever regulations a university may have with regard to the appointment of senior members of staff, the vice chancellor, the deputy vice chancellor, the registrar, and so forth, to make sure that those regulations refer directly to the institutional forum and make it a requirement for the institutional forum to advise the council on the appointment of those individuals. And some of those things are not necessarily happening within the regulations and the rules of the university. Institutional autonomy, in my whereabouts with regard to this, all UTAS and everybody else accept the fact that there comes a stage that the university, that the minister can rightfully intervene and take decisions that may impact on institutional autonomy. And what we're proposing here is to make that absolutely clear. In the instance of a directive issued by the minister, there's no implication for institutional autonomy. That's a proactive and a constructive engagement, allowing the council and the university to sort out matters brought to its attention by the minister. And it's now drafted in a way to say that even where the minister is supposed to indicate how he or she would like the problem to be resolved, that the institution now can make counter-proposals in terms of the amendment to say, we don't think that's the way to resolve it. Maybe this should be the way to resolve it. And that it would be an agreement with the minister with regard to that. But the accountability comes in. If nothing is forthcoming from that, then further intervention by the minister is open. The current arrangement is that if the minister issues a directive and he's not happy, he must put that institution under administration. He's saying that the hard handed way of doing things. Let's have this engagement through directives, and there are examples in the system at the moment where universities have actually responded much more aggressively to what they would respond if they've been placed under administration to deal with those matters. And those universities can be mentioned. But it's a much better way of proactively engaging, trying to find a solution. But at the end of the day, everybody would realize if you have financial irregularities and the council is not prepared to deal with it, or you have corruption, or you have terrible management, and the council do not have the guts to deal with it. This is a public institution, it's public resources. Now comes the time for the minister to act. But the conditions and the procedures to be followed must be clearly legislated. And I think this amendment is trying to assist with regard to that. Guys, just in conclusion, say something about transformation. I think it's fair comment to say that this
we need to understand maybe more clearly what transformation is all about. And it's not my idea to give a definition of it. I think we can go away and consider whether we should have some sort of definition, which is going to be extremely difficult. But what is in here is now that the minister could set transformation targets for the sector. And how would that happen? And also, he could develop a framework for the prior recognition of prior learning. How would that happen? Currently, the minister would eventually decide on the enrollment targets, the enrollment targets for institutions, individuals, specify in great detail, what for humanities, what for engineering and stuff. Now, how does that happen? It's not the minister sitting at his desk and now decides the University of Pretoria should do this, and Sefaku Mokgatu, health sciences should do that. There's an interactive process. It's an iterative process where all of those are being discussed against the broader target of government with regard to this matter, and eventually a particular agreement is concluded between the minister and a particular university. And those institutions are being held to that. If you do not enroll the students that you're supposed to enroll, your subsidy allocation will reflect that. And there is a penalty built in there. What I'm saying, Madam Chair, and I'm concluding, is with regard to transformation targets, why should there be a different process with a view to establishing that? It will be an inclusive and iterative process, as we've seen in recent times. If you don't deal with those critical matters identified in this document in a focused and in a systematic way, you end up with what we've been experiencing over the last couple of months. Thank you.
The last one.
One quick response to the issues of the financial implications when Section 65D is implemented. Chair, 65D is dealing with the implementation of your trade and occupational qualifications within a public institution. Now, your trade and occupational qualifications, the funding implications, are dealt with by way of your levies in terms of funding through the CITAS or funding through the National Skills Fund. And therefore, it is actually providing for the financial basis. There are no new financial implications as a result of this provision. The issue pertaining to the conflict of interest when it comes to the students and the staff, Prof. Tabeel already mentioned that, but there's also another aspect that one has acknowledged, and that is conflict of interest is not that it is the end of the world if there is a conflict of interest, but it is the intention is to provide the decision maker with all the relevant facts by declaring it up front and deal with it as a decision to say, will that specific circumstances have an impact? Improper impact on the decision in the end. It is a known fact, it's a declared fact that the student will have some interest. A staff member will have some interest. And therefore it's already there. The decision maker knows about it. The proposal on the table is those interests that are not known. That you need to get that on the table for the decision maker to take, and not to be in a situation that all possibilities of a conflict of interest will nullify their involvement. But what would be the impact of that specific circumstances on the decision is what it is about.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. I think there's just two things. The one is in relation to the financial issues, as the Chris Borshaw did indicate, in terms of the DCTO type program. But generally in the system, the way in which we work with universities is if there is any new development that's taking place and the minister has requested that development, there will be a process around how that is put in place and how financing of that
is met. It would never be that the institution will be demanded to do something where there's a huge financial implication and that is not taken into account. We're currently in the process of looking at the issue of the development grant, which is part of both the teaching development and the research development grant. And we're looking at a process where we'll make a grant available for those new aspects that come in. So it doesn't need to be identified specifically in this Act, but also this Act has gone through the CS process to look at the various implications of the Act, and we do not see this as having any major financial implications. The other one that I think has been mentioned and that perhaps we need to talk to is this issue of the power. I think Mr. Kasson had indicated, Honourable Kasson had indicated that could there be a better way of dealing with you know, this issue of an adverse finding by an independent assessor. We thought of all sorts of different ways, and there was a long debate about this. But in the end, the minister is the executive in terms of higher education, and therefore he is the one who needs to make that final proposal. Should there be an implication that the minister is not acting in terms of his responsibilities, then I suppose Parliament would pick that up and there would be the oversight from Parliament. I don't think it's possible for us to put into the Act something other on the assumption that a minister is not going to act in a trustworthy position. We have to assume that the minister is going to be acting in that way, which we would put in there. If there is a better way, we would need to be informed of what the best way would be. So I think that is the other issue.
Thank you very much. Observations are that we have now come to the end of this interesting engagement. But before I allow the DG his closing statement, I will request the, I'm not sure if I'm addressing you correctly, Advocate Buyo. Just your comment. Advocate Buyo is representing the committee, legal advisor for the committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. As I introduced myself earlier, I'm the parliamentary legal advisor, and what I have done is look into the questions that have been asked by the members as well, in order to also apply myself on them. And what we normally do, we're together with the departmental legal advisor as well as the federal advisor to look in, assist the committee in dealing with the questions or issues of clarity and so on. So if those questions we look into, and especially in the respect of the issues that will be brought up by the members of the public or the organizations that will come and raise issues, we assist in that respect. Thank you.
Thank you very much. DG, your closing statement.
No, thank you very much. We are extremely delighted in respect to the development thus far in the development of this Higher Education Amendment B. And we are looking forward to a full engagement as well as sharing in the wisdom of the Honourable Member. As you could say, that the Parliamentary Legal Advisory Services agree with us. So we wish you a fruitful participation going forward on the field. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, I can say so far so good. Remember, as the process unfolds, we will be more vigorous in terms of engagement, which is necessary so that the end product can be sustainable. All right, honorable members, DG and your team, we indeed had to converge here this morning to take the lawmaking process in the Department of Higher Education and Training forward. In line with the lawmaking process, the committee has received a briefing on the Higher Education Amendment Bill, and clarity was provided by the department where it was sought.
In the briefing, the objectives of the bill were clearly put and explained. The areas of focus were flagged and explained. From now on, the sequence of events will be added of the bill to allow the citizens of this country, address of the bill in the national and provincial newspapers to allow citizens of this country to participate in this law-making process by making written submissions to be followed by oral submissions to the committee. And thereafter, the committee will conduct public hearings and the department will form part of those public hearings so that they hear for themselves what the people say about the bill. This is a stage that will be followed by all submissions. I'm talking about your written submissions and your oral submissions. Submissions being referred to the department for their consideration and response to those oral submissions. This process will then be followed by a meeting with the Department of Higher Education and Training for the department to provide those responses to the meeting and for record purposes. Another meeting with the Department of Higher Education and Training will be to consider the bill clause by clause, followed by a portfolio committee meeting for consideration of matters, all matters that the committee will consider to be important to be reviewed after all the engagement and taking into consideration the public input. And thereafter adopt a report that will be tabled to the House, followed by a debate, I know a vigorous debate, and then followed by a House resolution. After that, the Honourable Speaker will refer the bill to the NCOP for further consideration by the NCOP. In the case of the bill being passed, the bill will then be tabled to the President for the President to assent to the bill, completing the lawmaking process. Well, it is clear this process is time-bound, meaning that all the stakeholders that we needed at all times would have to avail themselves so that we meet the time requirement or prescript. But also what will be important is quality preparations and quality input, so that indeed we end up with a quality and a sustainable piece of legislation that will propel the work of the department or the operations of the department to greater heights. All right. As I conclude, I really would like to thank the honourable members for their relevant interventions, I repeat, relevant interventions in the engagement with the department. I'd also like to thank the DG, Mr. Wes Konde, the DG's Professor Didier, for your quality work, and the officials of the Department of Higher Education and Training for the briefing on the Higher Education Amendment Bill. This takes us to the next phase. I have already alluded to the fact that on how the phases will be unfolding and the timeliness of our intervention so that we miss the time that is prescribed for this process to come to an end. Let me not forget to thank all the other stakeholders for showing interest in our work. Indeed, we really appreciate it. It means a lot to us. The meeting stands adjourned.
No, sorry. The meeting between ourselves and the department, sure, I nearly made a mistake, is done, and then we will take a 5-minute break to allow maybe the honourable members just some short break and then come back so that you can finish the work of the meeting.
Thank you.
I'm told that the TSEF, they regret something on your way out. Maybe my own analysis.
Honorable members, shall we reconvene? In terms of the agenda, we are on item number 6, which is consideration of the draft first term program. A copy was circulated to honorable members. I'd like us to look at it on page 1. On page 1, it is as reflecting on the program. Page 2, any comments? Any addition on page 2? Alright, just to indicate, we were going to read it under correspondence, but I do want members to understand why the shift from the site visit from the 2nd to the 5th. We received a communique from the Chronicle, the House Chair, whereby he is requesting that we don't have site visits on this date because of a meeting between Chairpersons and Whips that will be addressed by the House Chair and the all Chairpersons and Whips. So he even went to an extent of saying that the oversight visits by committees are not compulsory. He was actually trying to motivate that during this week we should allow the meeting between the chairperson and the whips. Because still at the beginning of the year, I think they want to plan with the chairperson and the whips. So that is the reason why we have now changed our program on starting from the 2nd to the 5th. But on Wednesday, that day will be open, and what have we put there?
Yes, we have invited Malusi to come and brief the committee on the quality assurance of last year's TVET colleges results, as well as colleges, as well as the State Information Technology Agency, to come and brief us on the progress report on eradication of the NCV certification clock for next Wednesday.
Okay, it's a proposal. Are honorable members happy with that? Last year, we called CETA to assist in fast-tracking issuing out of certificates, the certificate backlog. So this time, we then decided to use just that Wednesday for them to come and give us the feedback on the progress made with regards to addressing the certification backlog. Okay, honorable member, yes.
My question is, in terms of the logistics, because we're supposed to be going to Eastern Cape and KwaZulu-Natal, so are we going to be first in Eastern Cape and then Umalusi and Steve are going to meet us there? Or are we going to go from there to Cape Town to KZN, or how is that going to work exactly?
Okay, Secretary, can you come in?
Next week, we're going to have a meeting here in Parliament. We're not going to go to our site. So on Wednesday, we're calling Umalusi as well as CETA here in Parliament on Wednesday. So what long are going on our site?
Which is why I read the letter from the chair, the House Chair, that is impacted on our program. I have said they've written a letter to say the request that we shift, yes, the site visit during the week that starts from the 2nd to the 5th. Because of a meeting that has got to, I think it's a sort of a planning meeting of chairpersons and whips, which they thought should be prioritized because it affects all the committees. So we're not the only ones. But that week, we have found that there's an open day on Wednesday, which we then decided in a management meeting that we must then invite the CETAs to come and give us progress report with regard to the certification backlog. We want to know what progress has been made.
Yeah, sure. I misunderstood that information. Okay. To when will that oversight be postponed? Are we still going to look at that?
Okay, I want Anneli to talk to
Yes, in the next committee oversight period, that's when we are going to go on oversight. But at the moment, the new parliamentary program for the first time has not yet been distributed, so we're still waiting for that one.
So we're not completely writing it off from our program, but we're postponing it for later. Agreed, honorable members? Thank you, Mr. Mbasa.
Chair, thank you very much. I just want to check with you. With due respect to the suggestion that says women who say the sister should come next week, for me, my biggest worry is NSFAS. Will it be possible that we twist around that and actually make NSFAS and the Department of Higher Education next week rather than the 10th? I think the 10th will be too late for me, knowing what I know right now. I think at some point it will be important that we get things while they are still early to explain, rather than having to explain the major height of maybe difficulties. I think by that time, the time of third shepherd, most universities, if not all, will be operational. And as such, that will be the start of some of the things that have been difficult last year. It will be better to hear the solution a week early. This is my submission.
And what's your proposal?
We are just changing the presentation of NSFAS and the Department of Higher Education to the next week, Wednesday, and then moving Umelusi and Sita to the 10th. That's my suggestion. What I'm advancing as a reason is that we do need to know their plans as constituting the inherent problem that they've been trying to resolve and report to us.
Okay. There's a proposal on the table. Honorable members, what's the take? Honorable member, Kasim, and honorable member.
Chairperson, I agree with the proposal, but we must impress on both the department and NSFAS to be properly prepared, because we want to be able to engage with what is the current state of affairs, rather than just, you know, normal reporting and so forth.
Any counter proposal? Honourable Member Gillian?
Chairperson, just to indicate that I think it would not be suitable to adjust it, simply because if we look at the objectives, they would probably be in a better position 1 week later. But not only that, some of us are also serving in other committees. And the problem is that because we have prioritized the overnight visits, but now it is possible to participate in some of the training in other committees, for instance, because it takes place in Parliament. It is going to be impossible for us necessarily to all be here, and NSFAS and DHEC presentation is a very important one, whereas the Umalusi one, we can actually try to be present intermittently whilst we're also attending some of the training that takes place. So I would like to make a counter proposal that we actually adopt the proposal made by the committee secretary, and that is my proposal. Thank you.
Okay. Now I would like to check who are supporting the first proposal, and then those that please do that by show of hands. Those who are supporting the proposal that we swap the dates. Okay. To those that are proposing that we retain the proposal made by the officials, that we don't swap the date. Okay, let's go. Majority rules. So it means we will then not swap, because most of the members think it should not be suitable.
With your respect, Yusha, I think the motivation advanced by Honorable Killen is not satisfactory to me. If you say, for instance, we have cancelled the oversight and we are proposing to replace the oversight with a sitting of the committee, and halfway through the journey, you indicate that there could be other activities that might make the serving members of the committee not to participate on that day, which means they are competing activities, then to me it's all the same notion. I don't know if you understand it. If we are supposed to sit, why can't you just all sit? If you make an apology, then you make an apology. But you make an ideal situation, not idea. For instance, so assume that by making us to come here and sit while others have got an advanced apology, I think it's not fair. Because we can also do that and make the committee not to keep the quorum. But I think we must always be advisable that we were trying to set a mood where we don't feel used as some other members of the committee that we are attending because there is an issue which the members of the governing party have an interest or not. I think the issues of the committee are all the same and equal. But what I was motivating, which I do not think it should be discussed any further, is that at some point the sequence assistance will be much more advised than just to assume that the situation is going to solve itself.
Okay, I think I take most of the concern raised, but in terms of the consensus, more people who agreed on us retaining the proposal as tabled. That of us proceeding with the Umalusi on Wednesday, on the 4th, am I right? Is it the 4th? On Wednesday, and then we then proceed with the department on the 10th of February. Shall we then look at the other activities? Is there another hand? Are you responding or raising a new matter? Okay.
I was just checking the date of Wednesday next week, Chair. That is the only matter.
Okay.
So obviously, I just wanted to make sure that was Wednesday the 3rd.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Wednesday the 3rd, we have Manusi to give us a report on the certification backlog. We want the progress made in this regard. All right, page 3. Any other proposal on page 3? Are we happy? Are we agreed? Page 3 agreed? Ms. Keegan?
Just ask a question. I just have a little bit of a concern over our public hearing and the venue for it on Wednesday the 17th of February. Committee Room 1 is really not ideal, Chairperson. And since legislation is a key role of Parliament, and this is a public hearing, I was just wondering if we cannot appeal to the leadership to in fact provide us with a better venue for the public hearing.
All right, I think point taken. We will look into that and then we will then communicate. Because remember, we get allocated. So we go back, renegotiate, and then if there are changes, we will come back to the member. Honourable Member Bozoli, Professor Bozoli.
Chair, I have written to the committee secretary expressing concern about having public hearings during the SONA debate. I think on the Thursday after the SONA debate, the Wednesday night, is that right? And then there was, I'm sorry, I just have my share in front of me, I didn't bring that stuff here. the SONA debate continued after the president had spoken, and the opposition days are the days after the members. And we are all required by our whips to be there on those days. We can't not attend the phone debate. So I'm just wondering if we shouldn't change that or whether the secretary has already managed to change. Thank you.
Okay, what's your proposal?
Simply that we find another day for the public hearing.
Okay, because earlier on I did indicate or talk to the time frame, ne? We're going to strictly, you know, time so that we don't miss out on the delivery date. I think the best proposal would be we have it up to 1, and then find another day where we can make up for the other half. How is that?
Well, some accommodation would be...
Up till 1 o'clock?
The other thing about it is that during the Parliament is completely locked down. it's very difficult for the public to get onto the parliamentary precinct. I'm just wondering whether that isn't also a problem.
Thanks for raising that. I think it's something that we will look at, because we were allocated a room, because remember, you then make submissions so that we can find a venue on time. Otherwise, these venues run out, so people travel. So we will also look at that, then look at what's feasible. We will communicate. But for now, let's take it that we will sit from 9 o'clock until 1 o'clock, pending further investigation and findings on whether people will be let in on the Sonia Sona Day, State of the Nations Day. Eh? Oh, the thing for Sona is now you're right, it's responses to the Sona. Yeah. Questions to the Sona and responses by the, yeah. So it's a debate. Yeah, so that's okay. Right? Yes, Ms. Kassim, I don't know whether you've got Professor Poroli. It's not a Sona Day, but it's responses.
It's a Sona debate, which takes place over 3 days.
Yeah. Mm, all right. We were making a mistake thinking that it's Sona, and remember you said on Sona people will not be allowed to come. So all of us were a little bit, you know, confused, but now we are clarified. It was just the responses by the President to the Sona debate. Okay, Mr. Kassim?
Jefferson, look, just on that last point, even if it is a Sona debate, I hope that, and I hope we can resolve that, we will not be made to miss any of the themes of the House. Because we are required to be in the House and the House sits.
Okay.
The second point is, I would have anticipated, Chairperson, that on such an important moment in the higher education landscape, when we are doing public hearings on the higher education bill, that we would have taken at least one of these hearings to an institution of higher learning, to a university which it affects, so that we can encourage broader participation amongst the public. But merely to just hold these things in rooms here in Parliament does not necessarily give life to take in Parliament to the people, number one. But number two, to broaden access to these hearings, and there's only two of them, to be able to ensure that we can encourage even students to participate who may not be able to come here during the day.
Okay, Honourable Members, there's a proposal by Honourable Member Kassim. Could you please respond to that? Honourable Member Mbata?
Chairperson, I think it is a good transition to hear what Honourable Kassim is saying, and I think it will be exemplary to the terrain and the sector that we are at. If we are in Cape Town, I will suggest, for instance, that we choose among 5, 6, whatever the number, and then help the staff inquire if there are better venues in those institutions. I will imagine, for instance, it will be historic to see if we can have it at UWC, UCT, and look at those that have actually edged out in the past year or so on various activities and various struggles. I think to me this is a courtesy call to them to have some of these hearings held in their facilities.
Okay, there is a proposal that we look at holding one of the public hearings in one of the institutions of higher learning. And if I understood you correctly, you then made a proposal on either UWC, this is the Western Cape, or UCT. The proposals on the table, okay? Honourable Members, may I request members to participate? For now, it's me and Kassim and Mata. I don't agree, I don't accept it. Okay, Honourable Member Mkunu. Remember, he's not recognizing Honourable Member Mbata. So Honourable Member Mkunu.
I think I also had a problem. I didn't know what time was the debate starting. But if it's 2 o'clock, I think it's fine. We will start from 9:30 to 1. I think we can agree on the transfer of both days. But as for changing all the venues to going to universities, I think it's too much of a short notice. Maybe next time we can explore that avenue and it will be a good one. But for now, maybe let's just stick to, the shape.
Thank you. Honorable member, Lian, and then honorable professor, and then honorable member, Yeka.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, just a question with regards to the program as currently the draft program. I was under the impression that usually it is presented to the chairperson of committees, and that he then also the prioritization of legislation usually, and that is why I was arguing for a better venue, because usually that is a very important function of Parliament. I'm just concerned, Chairperson, that if we are restricted in terms of time, there may be a problem if we cut away from the public hearing time and then all leave for the debate. I hear what the honourable members are saying, but I can assure members that the chairperson of committee, Honourable Frolic, is not going to be too keen to accommodate us on that score, so that we only work morning shifts and not all in the afternoon. Usually, we check the debate, you go in when your members are speaking, etc., and for the rest of the time, you participate in the public hearing. So I just want to be cautious as far as that is concerned. Let's try, but we must be aware that I suppose the program has been submitted, and therefore he's already dovetailed the different committee programs, etc. So just a caution about that. Secondly, the issue of going to other venues, yes, it's in principle not a bad thing, but I think since we have a limited time when you deal with legislation, it's also a very structured process. Written submissions, and then upon receiving those submissions, people are slotted in, etc. The coordination of that is very time consuming. So due to the time constraints that we have, we're talking about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I would certainly not support it for this exercise. In future, let's do it. Thank you.
Okay, Professor? Or is it the same school? Professor? Or Prof?
Chair, the short time does worry me, because in answer to my question as to whether they've had any written submissions, they haven't even asked for them, which, by the way, I think is unprocedural, and this law may not be being pursued legally, it could have never asked for written submissions. The people who might be giving in written submissions are not necessarily the same ones who are on the committee. And I've never heard of a bill that has not asked for written submissions at the draft stage. And then the second point I want to make is, when is the advert going to be put out for oral submissions for people to come and present to us their opinion on the bill? And is there enough time for them to prepare? Because the moment the ad will probably only go out next Friday or something, then they're only going to come here the week after and already give their submissions. I think we're going to have objections from the public saying they need more time to prepare, and I think we are going to have to extend the period of consultation. I just don't see it as being viable or procedural for it to be rushed like this. Thank you.
All right, Honourable Member Kekan.
Chair, the first request is that if you could humbly cast your eyes around all members, because often we raise hands and you're not seeing us. Like last time, Kenyan had to draw your attention. I was raising my hand for a long time, because that gives an impression we are not participating. Why are you raising hands and you don't see us? So the request is if you could cast your eyes and make sure you see all members when hands must be raised. The second point is that I don't think in terms of attending to a particular venue, we can make that decision now. We'll have to give ourselves time to focus, because we need to look at all arguments for and against it before we can decide. So either we break now and take a short focus and come back with a decision after considering, because indeed The principle alive allows, but practicability will have to be considered.
Whoever speaks now, can you please assist us to round up this discussion? We are still on page 3. We have other pages to look at.
Chairperson, I feel I wanted to raise a point. I wasn't sure what point it is, but for the work of the ANC in this committee to suggest a caucus is unprecedented. Number one, and I've actually find it in bad taste, because in the past we have asked for time to caucus on matters that have arisen, and you have told us, and you've showed leadership, Chairperson, to say we're not here to represent different interests, but we are here to represent a common interest. That is something that you have led by example. So I just think that I must raise the point, and I find that very, very disappointing, because in the past we've been admonished for suggesting that we should do those kinds of things. As a way forward, Chairperson, if there is a will, there's a way. If we want to take this public participation process to the public, there is always a way to make it happen. It should not be a political decision as to what is the pros and cons for a specific political organization. Should we take this to a university or should we not? It should be a principled decision that in the spirit of public participation of such a landmark piece of legislation, in a time when education is in the spotlight in South Africa, that we as Parliament take the lead, that we are going to create access for public participation in this process so that we can get a buy-in of students. So we don't have students tomorrow burning down buildings because they say you did not consult with us, and you have not taken us as important and into consideration. So I want to say that when there is a world, there is a way. Even if we have to start next week, Chairperson, even if we have to start, even if we have to put a separate day aside on Friday, whatever it takes, but I'm sure we can leave it to the committee secretary to make it possible to put at least a day aside to go to one of the universities, to advertise it amongst the students. Students of different campuses can come together at that university and to have a say as to what legislation will cover their institutions.
Okay, I'm going to allow the secretary to respond to some of the issues that were raised.
Thank you, Chair. The address of the bill will go out this weekend in Sunday newspapers as well as in other provincial newspapers to advertise in the 11 languages. We allow people a period of 2 weeks to submit their inputs and prepare the program before we do the public hearings. On the issue of doing the public hearings outside Parliament, as members are aware that during that week there will be a debate in the House, so as well as on Thursday there is a caucus, so the only other day which we can explore is a Friday, if members will agree to extend the public hearings. So if we don't commit them during the 2 days, we can explore Friday unless if members agree. So that's the only day, Chair, that we can use to forward the public hearing.
Chair?
I'm trying to look at where the second week would fall on so that we then take a progressive move in this discussion. Okay, Honourable Member Mbada?
Yeah.
The 30th is the day when the advert will go out, okay?
Chair, I think we have to anticipate fairness. If we say the advert goes out, probably on Sunday, and then according to the Secretariat, the public has to be given exclusively 14 days. I'm assuming that is the 14 days prescribed. That actually goes straight to the first citizen. If you calculate, it goes straight to the date of the 17th.
Not 17th, February.
Yes.
It should be the 14th.
No, it goes straight to the 17th. The 4th?
Do you count the weekend? The 14th day.
Do you count Sundays? Okay.
But the week is made of 7 days, don't you? That includes your weekend.
Chair, I suggest we also consider a Friday of that week, of that first week. That Friday is 19th. Because you see, when you request an alteration to the chair of chairs, you must also show commitment as a committee. For me, I think this is the most important process that the committee will ever enjoy in our church. And I think let's display some measure of participation of what is it that at least we want to extend to the public. And I think giving the public time and more days is a show of our dedication to the cause of this amendment. I think if you also consider the higher education has been very much alive more recently. And I do think that there will be a lot of contributions. And I think let's build that in our planning. The issue of the venues, I think the ANC collective must understand that we really request that the venues must be open and accessible. We are not meaning that we are planning that those venues should be something else. We just, a venue like this, for instance, it's open and accessible. And that committee at 90 Plain Street is horrible. It's horrible. You can't do anything in that committee. There is a staff dining hall. There is a toilet not nearby. I mean, really, we must respect it. And the public also must be respected.
I know that when decisions are taken, it's not a question of you of being disrespectful. Question of what venue is available. We take note of your concern. I think we can maybe allow her to go and check on where we can find a better venue. Why we are discussing it is because we also want your quality input in this process. And can I appeal to all the members who are speaking here? Remember, this is a portfolio committee on higher education and training. In terms of democracy, it is an inclusive committee. But in our engagement, shall we rise above our political party lines and focus on education and how we can propel it to greater heights. I think that will assist us. Thank you very much. And then, honourable member, Kevin.
Yes, I go along with your summary now, because indeed education is highly important, and critical issues have been raised now by our students, which we should address. But obviously, if we're going to take education and turn it into politics and point scoring, it won't help the situation. The situation will only be assisted if we are genuine and we address education. I mean, practicabilities can't be avoided. So I go along with you that we go and look for a good venue here and come back with that. But also it is highly frustrating when we start politics as an issue, because then we want to go quiet and that doesn't help the real issues that are there for us to address.
Actually, members are raising a genuine concern, because in our public participation, we also expect people who will be on wheelchairs. So whatever venue we use, that venue must be accessible. So we'll appreciate you taking note of that, and then the secretary will work on that, and then we will come back to you with regard to those venues that are not accessible. Honourable member, Kasim, do you want us to proceed on page 3?
Just for clarity, Chairperson, because there were two proposals. Is there a agreement that we should look at utilizing that Friday and perhaps going on to a campus? Just
what will be the date on that Friday? 19. Okay, honourable member, it's in your hands. Can you debate and give a clarity or a way forward on that? There's a proposal that we take a Friday, we sacrifice a Friday, and then we go out for our public hearing to one of the institutions of filing. We will then also have to agree as the collective on which one. It was, I mean, 26 of them. So we have to agree on which one, and then so that the facilitation is made easier. Yes, honourable member Killian.
Mr. President, I was under the impression that there was a clear indication that the principle were good that we go to other institutions, but for process this time round, it's not possible. If the advertisements will be going out, I mean, we can't within the next 2 days decide on a venue outside. We must first go to the chairperson of committees to determine if we can shorten the committee deliberations during public hearings on those 2 days of the solar debate. And then we must, and that was part of the negotiating tool that I thought we were taking to him, to say the committee is committed and therefore we want to propose that we will be meeting on a Friday to extend the period, because we are only going to have half-day public hearings on the solar day. That's what I understood. So Friday would then be suitable, but that was the understanding that it would also be taking place here at Parliament, which is perfectly accessible, provided that we get a good venue. And on a Friday it wouldn't be a problem, it shouldn't be a problem. So Chairperson, I thought that was the proposal before the committee, and that there was broad support for that proposal. Thank you.
Any other view? Remember, you sponsored the view, so we're still debating it until we arrive at a consensus.
Chairperson, the argument that was made initially of not going to a campus was that during the solar debate we cannot make it back in time and there is not another time. That is where the proposal of the Friday came from initially. Actually, if you recall the debate that had taken place. If Honorable Kian thinks it's not possible, that's fine. But can we at least allow the Secretary to go and do what is possible to make it possible? And if it is really impossible, then it's impossible. But can we at least allow? Because there's no argument to be made that if it is possible, why not take it to a campus? Even on Kilian says she agrees with the principle. So if on Kilian agrees with the principle, we all agree with the principle, then let us put the principle into effect. And if it's not possible, then of course it won't be possible.
Honourable Member Kekana, to be followed by Honourable Member Suel.
To be honest, people bear with me. I really can't see Kasim's desperation. Because the issues that students are raising, we've had many meetings, not just one, with them about those issues. Those issues are clear. And I don't understand how they can make their issues clearer in a different venue outside Parliament than inside Parliament. And we've had many meetings, we've had many press discussions. The minister has also done so. So really, I push for this type of desperation, I really don't understand. Especially when our own secretary in the portfolio has indicated that there are time constraints and budgeting issues and many parliamentary issues. So, Chair, I would request that we go along with this and that we should look for an accessible venue within Parliament and leave out this declaration that Karim is indicating, which we really don't understand. Students will raise their issues, they've raised their issues in the future, they can raise those issues here. I don't see why we should go to UCT. If we go to UCT, maybe the VET students will say, why not VET? We can't travel to UCT ourselves. The TEFLO students will say, why don't you come to TEFLO? So one institution can't cover all of them, but we have called meetings with SRC for the whole country, and really, really, this push that is indicated personally, I can understand. So I suggest look for an acceptable venue here on the premises of Parliament.
Okay, I know you are talking, but I haven't recognized. Can we follow the procedure? Is there any? Yeah, we have Mr. Suela, and if there are other follow-ups, they will come after Mr. Suela.
Chairperson, my understanding of the situation is that we have made proposals to you and the secretary for you to look at and do whatever is possible for us to be able to proceed with the public hearings. And then you will look at all the other issues that we've raised And you can always come to us with what is doable and what is not doable. I don't see the fact. Why should we waste time talking about it? The only concern though that we have is that our committee room is too small for a public hearing, and I think that it should be considered.
All right, there's a proposal that a lot of progressive issues are raised, and we have said we take note of that. So as we go back, the officials must take that into consideration and then advise on a way forward. Agreed? Okay. Thank you very much. Let's then move on to the next page, page 3. I hope this time we will not over-labor the matter. Page 4. This is a program for this first quarter of the year. And then page 4 takes up to March, from the 2nd of March to the 23rd of March. Agreed? Okay, Honourable Member Kassim.
Who? Bata. I see we have another oversight study board, which is obviously the one that was postponed. I'm just trying to check, Chairperson. It would look to me after the 30th, I mean after the 23rd of March.
Mm-hmm.
It signals actually the end of our financial year.
First quarter year.
Yeah, and it will mean effectively we will have never made it to KZN and Eastern Cape for the entire year. And it will mean also we have forfeited officially one of the oversight that we had scheduled as a committee. So I'm trying to check. I'm trying to check if it's possible to still do something on those two processes. In particular, noting what is happening there, I think our visit will still be as important as it was planned.
Thank you, Honourable Member Mbata. We take note of your proposal that they must still be considered this year. Because this one is already full, we request that those be prioritized in the next 5 visits. Because in every quarter, we get told of the committee week. So for the next committee week in the next quarter, let's put all those that we're supposed to have visited last year. Are we all in agreement? Yes. Thank you very much. Shall we then move on to page 5? Page 5, okay, we're done. That's it. Honourable Members, any proposal for adoption of the program of action for the first quarter or first term of the year? Honourable Member Kian? Or it's Honourable Member Mkun? Sitting here, I don't see you clearly. All right. There's a proposal for move for the adoption with the amendments. Any seconder? Ms. Killian Sonnen and Ms. Gadimane has said it. Thank you very much. I think we've made good progress with regard to the program of action. Shall we then move on to consideration of the minutes of the 21st? And 28th of October. These minutes are circulated, Honourable Member. Shall we then look at the minutes, page 1, of the minutes of the 21st of October. Page 1. Page 2. Any proposal for adoption? Honourable Member Kadime, any seconder? Thank you very much. Seconded by Honourable Member Kiran. Right, second set, that of the 28th of October. First page. Second page.
Bless you. Second page. Third page. Fourth page. Fifth page. Sixth page. Any proposal for adoption? Honorable Member Kunu, any seconder? Honorable Member Keta. Thank you very much. Then the set of minutes of the 3rd of November 2016. Again here, page by page, first page, second page, third page, fourth page, page 5. Am I too fast? Oh, page 6. Any proposal for adoption? Honourable Member Gadimeng, any seconder? Honourable Member Mkul. Thank you very much. We now are looking at the minutes of the Standing Committee on Appropriations of the 4th of November. First page. Page number 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Any proposal for adoption? Honorable Member Mkunu, any seconder? Honorable Member Swell. Thank you. And then we're now looking at the last set of minutes. It's the set of the 18th of November. First page. Second page. Third page. Page 4. Page 5. Any proposal for adoption? Honorable Member Gadimeng and Honorable Member Ketana is seconded. All right. Thank you very much. We now on announcement. Honourable Member, now that the lawmaking process has started, I do want to announce that you have two key documents that you'll be using throughout. It is a document that you will keep so that they are not printed again. It's your Higher Education Amendment Bill. That document you should use as your Bible for this process. And the document is the principal document on Higher Education Act of 1997. So throughout this whole process, we'll be using the two documents. So you've got to keep them and we'll please have them all the time. We'll be using them as our guiding documents or source documents in all our engagements. Then any other announcements? Any other announcement maybe from the members, honorable members? Honorable Member Mbata, it's your birthday.
Major, no. Mine is on the 30th of August, if you can.
Okay. All right.
I'm just checking. Where is the 97th Amendment? I only have...
Okay, this one is the Act itself, ne?
Yeah.
The Act. It's Act number 101 of 1997. If you don't have, I'll request the officials to provide you with one.
Okay.
And then we have the deal. Yeah.
Lastly, on my request, so that I don't come back again, I just request that the secretary also email us the copy of the address. so as to allow us to attend information to the public.
Yeah, you are so right. I think what will make our engagement, our public participation effective is that we distribute as much information as possible. But this is what Parliament will do. There will be this advert, as you say, to Fitch Press and which other national paper? And their report, because you see we are a multiracial country. And it will also be the advert distributed to all the provincial newspapers. You see, so that everyone is aware. And then there will also be a public education on the bill by the communications unit, Parliament. So there will be public education. So, and then we have been allocated, our former media liaison officer left, so we have a new media liaison officer. I don't know whether he's in this room. Can we stand first so that we can see you? Okay. So our, thank you very much, our communication liaison officer will send out media alerts to promote broader participation for the citizens. So media alerts, so this is what is expected broadly, so that people can then be aware of this process and come on board and participate. But then I have no objection to the, let's ask the Secretary to send all members the update. I have seen it, I have a copy here, but then we were just waiting for this process because I'm told there was no, it was not going to be correct to advertise before getting the briefing to unleash the process. So after this, the address was okay. Thank you very much. The other announcement, we have been invited to a joint meeting with the Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology and the ourselves, the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training, with a delegation from Norway, yes. They are also focusing on education and research. So that's why we are meeting as a joint committee, just to exchange information. So this was planned by the Department of Science and Technology, because I wanted to know who came up with the agenda, but I was told that there was a joint meeting between the official Science and Technology and our officials. So they came up with this, and then the meeting will be starting at 12. Now, I know that members have got a concern about 12 o'clock. I'm not always informed to the decision to start at 12, because members have a concern about starting this late, 12 o'clock.
So the delegation is in Khayelitsha tomorrow morning, so they will only be arriving in Parliament at 12, so that's the time.
Okay, now we know what has informed the decision. And then the Department of Education will do a presentation on the whole school education and training sector in South Africa. We will be co-chairing. But can I apologize to this meeting that I have a very serious commitment. It's a health problem that I have to attend to tomorrow. Some of these doctors, it's difficult to find them. Once you find them, you'll find maybe in another 6 months. So I have this one. It's a long-standing one. I got it last year for this one. So I will then not be available. And they normally say when you want another chairperson to, I think it's a standard procedure. This meeting must elect that chairperson. So I think we must follow procedure to the latter. Yeah. So that person will then stay in for the chairperson in tomorrow's meeting. There's a hand by Honourable Member Kekan.
Chair, you are helping overtook mine. I actually have a very, very serious matter because I'm building a home because of the rain. Some construction has collapsed and I need to go back and fix it. I actually have people. So I was going to very humbly again request that I also be excused.
Shall I check on who will be available and then we then elect a chairperson from those that will be available tomorrow? At 12.
There were hands by Ms. Sabata and then Ms. Ms. Killian. Okay, remember that member just elected. You can raise your fist, but the process has not been finalized. It's an election process.
Tomorrow.
Okay. Now I've been corrected. That election must take place in the meeting. Not yet. I nearly made a mistake. But you can start me by my good intention. I really want us to do things correctly. Then we start right, okay? Tomorrow, when you get to the meeting, you'll have to elect a chairperson from the higher education and training. I don't know how you do it in a joint meeting. How do you do it in a joint meeting?
Everybody.
Come again.
From what I understand, because it's a joint meeting, everybody will participate from both portfolio graduates.
Oh, okay. All right. So who will facilitate? Okay, I'll talk to the chairperson of Science and Technology, and then, so that he facilitates, because he'll be there, because that person will co-chair with him. How is that? Everybody's doing things different, you know, it's exciting. Okay. Thank you so much. It does look like announcement. Correspondence, do we have any other correspondence? The only correspondent we had is the one that is from Mr. Frolic because it's impacted on our program. And then closure. Honourable members, thank you so much. And indeed, you started with Vim. Let's contain or let's maintain the standard. Take it, you know, a little bit higher. So last year it was high. But unfortunately, we're going to keep moving higher and higher. So moving forward, let's take it to another level again. And the next year, I'll say we work hard. Next year, this year harder, next year harder. Okay, thank you. The meeting stands adjourned. See the food, they have finished it up because they're wasteful expenditure. Yeah.
Thank you.